We are privileged to bring to you another series of spiritual conferences given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J., professor at St. John's University in New York. Father Hardin is a well-known retreat master, author, and spiritual director. Each conference in this series is separate in itself, and yet together they form a complete retreat, the overall theme being sacrifice and love. The heart of all spirituality is sacrifice, and a spiritual life not built on sacrifice is building on sand. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, the Sacred Heart and the Incarnation, humility. Father Hardin.
Our subject for the present conference is the Sacred Heart and the Incarnation. As we have seen, there are two sides to the Sacred Heart devotion. There is God's side and our side. The divine side is epitomized in the expression Sacred Heart, standing for and synthesizing all the manifold manifestations of God's love for us. Our side is expressed in the word devotion. It is our response in love to God's prior love for us. In the present meditation, we shall reflect on the Sacred Heart and the Incarnation, and look as is necessary to better understand not only what we mean, but how we are to practice the devotion to the Sacred Heart, to first ask ourselves, how did God show His love for us in becoming man? And then to ask ourselves, how are we to show our love in response and return? I think the best way we can synthesize the incarnation as the expression of God's love for us by calling it God's incarnate gift of love, with a stress on the word gift. When St. Paul speaks about the incarnation, he says, "The grace of God, our Savior, has appeared to all men." And he thus epitomizes in a sentence the depths of divine love in becoming man. Grace, we know in biblical language, first of all means love. And it is called grace precisely because it is given gratis, gratuitously, freely, with no coercion or compulsion from within, or necessity from without. It is the first divine gift from which all others proceed. That is, the gift of the incarnation is the fundamental grace on which and from which all other graces both derive and depend. But grace also means gift. Gift in the sense that the one who receives the grace is benefited by what he receives. in both senses, that is, both as love and a gift, the grace of the Incarnation is the highest from one viewpoint and deepest from another of divine love. By becoming man, as St. Paul tells us, God showed greater affection towards the human race than even towards the angels. For, as he says, it is not angels that he is ministering to. He is ministering to the offspring of Abraham. Mankind has thus been gifted. And this bears accent, has been gifted with more grace through the Incarnation and raised to a higher degree of glory than the angels, though by nature the angels are higher than man. Further evidence of the grace of God in the Incarnation is the fact that by comparison with this expression of divine love, everything else that God did or does pales into insignificance. The Incarnation has been called the masterpiece of God's love for man. A virgin conceives, and God is born of a woman. God descends into a stable in order that man might ascend to the very throne of God. Love, we know, is testified in three principal ways: in what we say, in what we do, and in how much we exert ourselves and suffer for the person whom we love. But where words merely lead us to believe that we are loved, we hope the person means what he or she is saying, as so many wives have sadly told me, "Father, you should read his letters before we married. Now look at him." And works, or what a person does, prove love in action more expressive and certain than words. But the highest and infallible evidence of love is when a person not only tells us he loves us or does something for us, but exerts himself for us, and in fact suffers to prove that he cares. Then we want to, almost in spite of ourselves, to love that person in return. That's what God did when he became man. In the Old Testament, and now we get closer to our subject, before this conference is over, we are going to get painfully practical. In the Old Testament, men dare to say of the Lord, "What does God know? He judges us as through a mist. The clouds are his covert, and he does not consider our affairs, for he walks about the poles of heaven." One guess where that comes from: the book of Job. So there is God in heaven enjoying himself. And look at me. But with the incarnation, all of that has changed. As the masters of spirituality tell us, no longer does God walk about the poles of heaven. He now lies in a manger bed of straw. And more than reflecting on or looking at the evils that men suffer, he now suffers along with us. Until God became man, he had really not known what it means to wander about at night, to be homeless, with no one to take him in. Well, he knows now, and much more besides. Hunger and thirst and cold are no longer strangers to God. And this is not rhetoric. It's our faith. It began in Bethlehem, in a stable, or as I prefer, in a barn. And it ended in Jerusalem on the cross. At the birth of Christ, all the other attributes of God were obscured and hidden from view, except one, his love. His power is scarcely visible, in that he became a helpless child, or better, he became a child in order to become helpless. His wisdom is hidden because he seemed, how I like to use that verb, he seemed unable to speak. He was the infant, the speechless one. Well, not quite. It was the speechlessness of love. And how we need to learn that. His goodness. That is his virtue. His moral goodness was hidden because he was made like us sinners and subject to the penalties of sin. His dominion over creation couldn't be seen because he took the form, as we are told by the apostle, of a slave. And the word is not servant, but slave. His happiness he withheld because he became filled with our miseries. And his majesty, because he chose to be born like an outcast in the company of witless beasts. No matter how poor we are, though I'm never sure, depending on the size of the audience, how safe the question is, have any of us been born in a barn? Usually I feel safe. In any case, this is what God did to show us how much he cares. in proportion, and this was really his purpose, to allow all his other attributes to be not only obscured, but almost totally hidden from view, in order that the greatness of his one attribute of love might be correspondingly more clear. So much for God's side of the picture. If the incarnation then is the great proof, the greatest, of God's love for us, we ask then, what should be our devoted love in return? God's love for us in the incarnation is meant to be a pattern of how we are to love Him in a way that corresponds to His goodness in becoming man. Let me say another word about this. What we want to bring out in this meditation, having briefly looked at the backdrop of God's love for us in the incarnation, is what lesson, what specific lesson does God want to teach us, not only in that we should love Him, but in how we ought to love Him, the method or the pattern or the model of how God loved us in the incarnation is the focus of our question of how should we then love Him in return. What is the design in the pattern? What's the theme? What's the master idea in God's love shown in the incarnation? The master idea is God's emptying Himself for us. The incarnation is God emptying Himself for us. If we are to love God correspondingly, and this is the focus of our reflections, if we are to love God correspondingly, we are to empty ourselves for love of Him. The biblical word is kenosis. He emptied Himself. Insofar as it is possible for God, without ceasing to be God, to hide His divinity, God did it in becoming man. I thought for some time as to how I might approach this vast subject, and decided, you'll never guess, that I would share with you what Saint Benedict, the founder of Western monasticism, we might say the father of Western spirituality, teaches in his famous rule about the practice of humility. What do I mean? I mean that the one basic quality of our responsive love of God in imitation of His love for us in becoming man is the practice of humility, or as we may better call it, the practice of humble love. Love has many qualities. It must have this one. Otherwise, it is not born of God. It must be humble. As Saint Benedict viewed humility, it covers, if you please, 11 steps. These are not necessarily dependent one on the other, which we get from the word step, but they are in a way stages indicating that there is progress as a person goes from the one to the other, but more accurately, that taken together, they offer a clear and, let me stress, practical norm of how to grow in humble love. The first six of these, call them stages of humility, refer to the internal dispositions we must cultivate. The last five have to do with our external actions, again, to be cultivated if we are to grow in that humble love, which for our purpose is our response to God's humble love in becoming man. Let me briefly mention each of these features of humility with just a word. It better be just a word on each one as a ready and tried method of loving Christ humbly in imitation of His love for us in the humility of the Incarnation. That's what the Incarnation is. It is the humility of God. The first of these stages of humility, having to do with interior dispositions, is the fear of the Lord. Now you might say to yourselves, I thought Benedict was a smarter man than that. Well, yes, he was all that smart. You see, that's what Revelation says, doesn't it? The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. We then humble ourselves, not even a craven fear of God's punishments, as though, because we're talking about love, as though we are mainly fearful of what God will do to us if we don't obey Him. No. It is that fear that only great love can produce, the fear of offending the one we love. How sensitive we are about the feelings, about the least desire or wish when we love, right? How we fear to hurt, how we dread to cause the least pain, how we hesitate doing anything that might possibly displease the one we love. Second, submission to God's will. Now again, you might say to yourself, is this love or is it fear? Oh, it's love, all right. Because why, we love, and we should grow in this love, but we never forget that the one we love is our God. We are not here loving our equal. We are loving infinity. And infinity, being God, has a right to, well, tell us how we are to love. And he does. You love me if you do my will. You love me as much as you do my will. No more and no less. Third stage, obedience to superiors out of love for God. You wonder, when is Benedict going to get sublime? Well, he knew. This is sublimity. Because that's what God did when he became man. He became man in order, listen, in order that he might, as man, obey other human beings. What an invention of infinite wisdom. That's why religious life was invented. Except God did the inventing. Remember, we're talking about humility, let's not forget. And we're matching our humility against God's. And we've got a lot to live up to. Fourth stage. Patient submission to humiliations from others. Dear Lord, why did you ever inspire Benedict to say this? After all, a better number would have been 10 stages. It would have been more even. Why make it 11? Why not skip this one? Well, it's right there. Notice. Patient submission. The implication always behind patience is suffering. That's what pati in Latin means, to suffer. And to suffer submissively. Now, this kind of submissiveness would be craven slavery and unworthy of man, as it would have been unworthy of the man Jesus, unless it is animated by the love of God. Hear it, because we can't hear it too often. This is one of the main reasons that God, to humble himself, became man. In order, Lord, do you mean it? I mean it. In order that he might endure humiliations. This is God. At the lips and eyes and hands. We can say this, his fellow men. What a statement to make about God.